Right then, I've been looking forward to this interview all day. In the Ace of Spades, Motorhead's most famous song that you just heard, Lemmy, the Born to Lose, Live to Win frontman of the band sang, I Don't Want to Live Forever. Yet as he told his friend of 35 years, former PR and biographer Mick Wall, actually, I want to go the day before forever to avoid the rush. This book, Lemmy, the Ace of Spades, is his true story. Brutally frank, painfully funny, wincingly sad, and always beautifully told, of course. Lemmy, the Ace of Spades, is the definitive story of the only rock and roller never to sell his soul for silver. Delighted to join on the line for about, I think, the third time in a year. Mick Wall. Mick, good afternoon.
Hi, Giles. Lovely to speak to you again.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Right then. I mean, I big Motorhead fan. He really was Lemmy. I mean, he really, you say he didn't sell his soul for silver. I mean, he really did stick to his guns. He was never in fashion. He was never... swayed by commercial pressures, but blimey, he didn't half cut a swathe.
He certainly did. I mean, I think it goes beyond even rock music. You know, we're used to wild, over-the-top personalities in rock, but I think Lemmy actually, by the end of his life, qualified for that same... more of that same category of great British eccentric. He was like the Jeffrey Bernard of rock and roll, or possibly Peter Cook or Dylan Thomas. He was one of those. I mean, the man wrote poetry. He was extremely kind and gentle, but at the same time, some of his best friends were Hell's Angels. He lived that life, not just in song, but in real life, off stage, to the day he died. I mean, as he often used to say to me, this isn't a costume I'm wearing. This is who he is when he gets up in the morning. I was going to say when he goes to bed at night, but that never used to happen very often, to
right.
be honest.
I mean, he wasn't an Alice Cooper, wasn't he? It wasn't all part of a stage act. I mean, this really was what you saw with the Jim Beam and the whole thing. Really was the JD really was the real deal.
Yeah, you'd never find Lemmy on the golf course, that's for sure. he wasn't the CEO of his own private company or anything like that. I mean, right up to the very end when the... let me tell you a better story. He once told me, as it relates in the book, that way back in the early 80s, his manager at the time took him to this Harley Street private doctor specialist to see if he could get a major blood change to try and rid him of all these chemical impurities, put it like that. And the doctor did a blood test and came back and said, listen, whatever you do, don't give him whole blood. It will kill him. By that stage, his blood had evolved into such a kind of toxic mix of alcohol and substances that he really was running on his own fumes.
But I mean, loathing what he did. I mean, I'm just listening to Ace of Spades there, and I obviously had a quick flick to the back catalogue to just get reacquaint myself with some of his oeuvre, so we say. But you can with Lemmy and Motorhead, and we'll go back in a minute to the early days and the Hendrix stuff. But he really did invent thrash metal.
No, he did. Well, I mean, he Motorhead kind of invented thrash metal with the double kick drum that Phil Taylor used on Overkill, which was the title track of their third album and one of their big breakthrough hits back in the late 70s. But Lemmy himself never understood distinctions between metal, rock, punk. As far as he was concerned, it was all rock and roll, and that's what Motorhead did. I mean, his whole background was, Little Richard, was Chuck Berry. I mean, the Beatles, Lemmy was old enough to have seen the Beatles when they played the Cavern. So he didn't grow up playing heavy metal. He grew up loving rock and roll, and that's what he always felt that he was doing.
But he's another one to come out of that sort of West Midlands powerhouse. I mean, you think of, Ozzy, Sabbath, Zepp. I mean, Lemmy was born in my part of the world, from Stoke-on-Trent.
He was, although in fairness, we have to also point out that, I mean, he left there when he was only a few years old. His father, who was a padre in the RAF, actually walked out on his mother when he was less than 3 months old. And so they went to live with his grandmother on his mother's side, which was out in North Wales. And That's where he grew up. That's where Lemmy first got expelled from school, first got fired from the Hot Point factory because he wouldn't wear a hairnet, and first went hitchhiking to find fame and fortune, first with the Rocking Vicars in Manchester, and then later, as he came down to London, he worked for Jimi Hendrix as a roadie, and then he joined Hawkwind.
Working for Jimi Hendrix as a roadie must have been an experience and a half. You can play on words as much as you like there, but you know, how did he end up doing that?
The usual rock and roll way, a friend of a friend. Don't forget, those are the very early days of the music business. It wasn't the sophisticated industry it is now. You really did have to know somebody who knew somebody, and the connection was largely a drug one. I mean, as Lemmy said, Jimmy only had like three roadies at the time, and one of them was Lemmy, and one of Lemmy's main jobs was to buy LSD for Jimmy. Lemmy used to say, Jimmy would send me out to buy seven hits of LSD. I'd take two and he'd take five. And still get on and do their jobs that night. So that was Lemmy's kind of baptism into London rock and roll scene.
And how did that sort of interesting, shall we say, lifestyle lead to him, you know, becoming part of his own band and Hawkwind? And just explain a little bit about how influential Hawkwind were, because they were a crossover between sort of psychedelia and heavy, weren't they?
They really were. I mean, again, you know, we have to kind of contextualize the late 60s. You know, the maps hadn't been drawn, the rules hadn't been written. These guys really were making it up as they went along. And Dave Brock, who formed Hawkwind, you know, tells me in the book that as far as he was concerned, he wanted Hawkwind to make music that was literally the oral equivalent of an acid trip. And if you listen to their first four or five albums, and Lemmy was on four of those, that's certainly the direction their music seemed to be taking. It was very improvisational, very out there. They used to see the band as a spaceship, and they used to see the main figures in the band, of which Lemmy, of course, was one because he sang their big hit Silver Machine. They used to call them the Captains, and the Four Captains. And so Hawkwind's whole trip, another play on words, was to expand your consciousness, broaden your mind, and freak you out. And you'd have to say, when it came to that sort of thing, they were a huge success.
We get quite a few listeners who phone in saying, you know, I saw Hawkwind, you know, in the early 70s, or I think I saw Hawkwind, you know, I'm not quite sure. Things got a little bit weird. Things got a little bit weird as well. I mean, Lemmy was fired for apparently taking the wrong drugs.
He was, in a nutshell. I mean, he was, the band were traveling in North America, and as they crossed over from North America into Canada, the bus was stopped and searched, and Lemmy was arrested for what the Canadian police assumed was cocaine, which of course was illegal. In fact, it wasn't cocaine, it was amphetamine sulfate, a similar looking substance, but not then actually illegal in Canada. So he was held in jail overnight, but the charges were dropped because what he was doing wasn't illegal in Canada at the time. But the band used that really as the excuse to get rid of him. They, as Lemmy tells me in the book, the band were very much split into two camps, the acid camp and the speed camp. And Lemmy was the captain of the speed camp. But there was also, to be honest, there was also, like with all rock bands, ego involved. You know, when Hawkwind had this massive, and it was an enormous worldwide hit with Silver Machine, it was entirely galling to Dave Brock and Nick Turner, the two leaders of the band, that it was Lemmy who sang the song. It was Lemmy then on the cover of music papers. It was Lemmy that everybody wanted the autograph of. And although they were supposed to be very egalitarian, you know, like all rock bands, they all crave the spotlight. And as far as they were concerned, Lemmy had kind of stolen it from them. And eventually they made him pay.
I mean, you leave Hawkwind, which is this big, sprawling, psychedelic starship with captains and the whole thing, and flying to, you know, interplanetary, whatever, galactic, gilly gook. And then you get Motorhead. And Motorhead, it really strips it down and goes back to basics with a three-piece. I mean, how did what happened there? What, because Lemmy could have gone off completely in a sort of Knights of the Round Table kind of way, couldn't he? I mean, it would have been more chemically impaired. But he decides to go back and get... I'm just thinking of that. I'm just thinking of some massive... anyway, let's not go there. But, you know, he goes back to basically, you know, the rock and roll that he's grown up with.
Well, yes. But, I mean, the thing is, you know, Hawkwind already existed before Lemmy came along. So, I mean, Lemmy didn't play bass until he joined Hawkwind. He kind of faked his way into the band because he needed the money. They were actually looking for a new guitar player. A new bass player. But Lemmy was a guitarist. So when he actually turned up for his audition... he just kind of fumbled his way through it, and they just went, oh, he'll be fine, and they just took him on, you know. So Hawkwind was never, although he loved being in Hawkwind, he tells me in the book that he'd never have left if he hadn't been sacked. That wasn't his first love. In fact, you know, he told me he once bumped into Little Richard in Los Angeles, and he went up to him and said, "No you, no me. You're to blame for everything." And that was Lemmy's passion, was the real raw rock and roll. So when he came to form Motorhead, he told me, what he had in mind was a British version of the MC5, who were this incredibly anarchic proto-punk metal band from Detroit in the late 60s. Kick Out the Jams was their famous number. Lemmy was enthralled to the MC5, and that's what he wanted to do with Motorhead. He wanted to have two guitarists and a drummer and him blazing away on his bass and his vocals. In the end, it turned out to be a three-piece, but that was very much the idea. Fast, furious, take no prisoners, but still, this is pre-metal, you know, still melodic and what you would call rock and roll.
And if you think about it, because Motorhead come out and, you know, they hit big with, you know, the first album, if you like. But in put it in context, you know, punk's coming out in the UK, a new wave's coming out in the UK, and yet they've got an album, No Sleep Till Hammersmith. Was it 79 it came out? I'm just thinking off the top of my head here. 78, 79. And right in the middle of all this, you know, heavy metal is dead and, you know, the overgrown Zeppelin is out the window and the Who have gone. Yet this rock band, you know, this no frills rock band really do make their mark and get a massive following that stays incredibly loyal right to the end.
Absolutely. I think where Lemmy and Motorhead, one of the kind of great blessings of being in that band at that time was they appealed to both audiences. I mean, the first Motorhead album came out in 78 when punk was at its height. But Motorhead would do co-headline gigs with The Damned. Lemmy, before that, Sid Vicious went to Lemmy for bass lessons. And Lemmy tried to give Sid bass lessons, but when it didn't take, he told him to give up.
Right.
Which arguably Sid did, you know. there are lots of pictures of Lemmy with Sid and Nancy and people from The Damned and people like that. He was always on the scene, and Motorhead songs were short, fast, fiery, raw, no frills. So that really did fit in with the punk crowd. The only big difference was, of course, all of Motorhead had really long hair, and Lemmy did have this backstory with Hawkwind. So, of course, major rock fans, biker fans, the real kind of cutting edge of rock fans, really took to Motorhead, loved Motorhead because of that uncompromising attitude, which it wasn't like, well, we're part of the new wave of heavy metal or we're punk. It stood apart from all of those things and was, you know, summed up in that song We Are Motorhead. I mean, that really kind of hit the nail on the head.
And live, I'm absolutely untouchable. I mean, this is the thing about Motorhead performances, and live, you said uncompromising, but a visceral experience and absolutely superb. I mean, No Sleep Till Hammersmith became an instant classic and is still referred to today.
Absolutely. I mean, that came out a year after, I remember going on a bus trip to see them in Aylesbury in England in 1979, and they tricked the bus out with raw hunks of meat dripping blood, blow-up Barbie dolls, and the hostesses on the bus were these three biker chicks clad in not very much at all, other than their leather jacket.
Pretty much the same how I arrived at the studio, to be honest with you, Mick.
Who spent the whole trip throwing drinks down your neck or trying to force you to do even more interesting things.
I'll say nothing because I'm on air, but there you go. So, yeah, well, go.
But I remember, one last thing, I remember when we got to the gig, it was so loud. I mean, it was, and don't forget, I'd worked for Black Sabbath, you know, I mean, I know loud, right? It was so loud, I remember tearing off the filters from cigarettes and shoving them in my ears to try and try and save my ears, because it didn't work. But, yeah, it was just a glorious, death-defying, completely rebellious, up-yours experience. And, of course, I think British people in particular love that. You know, they love that attitude. So, and of course, Lemmy was also very, very funny. There was a great sense of humour to what Motorhead did as well, and I think that came across too.
I was going to say, because it wouldn't have all worked if he'd just been a numbskull, but, I mean, I interviewed the late, great Rick Mayall a couple of years ago, and he told me about he'd worked with Lemmy on Eat the Rich, and they'd also done a few bits and pieces with the Bad News tour as well, and he was saying, you know, what an absolute laugh Lemmy was. And this goes through, because, you know, in the latter years, we have to recall him now, you know, he went to live he went stateside, and he was a huge influence you know, on the Americans, because as you said, he became this British eccentric, but was always, you know, he may have had a legendary alcohol and drug you know, intake, but he still managed to be pretty lucid and pretty funny as well.
He was extremely lucid, very erudite, very well read. I mean, if he went on the tour bus with the band, there would be Lemmy always with a book, quite often a book on the Second World War, but nevertheless, always with a book in his hand. He used to, in the 90s, he used to sometimes fax me some poems, which I used to find very wonderful, but of course unusual. In Los Angeles, where he went to live in the early 90s, he was treated like the rock god he'd always believed he should be. I mean, you have to remember that Metallica, who by then were the biggest heavy metal band in the world, their drummer and main spokesman, Lars Ulrich, used to run the Motorhead fan club in America. Guns N' Roses, who were the other biggest band in the world at that time, if you look at the early photographs of the band playing, you'll see Slash and or Duff both sporting Motorhead t-shirts. I once had Duff sing me We Are the Road Crew, one of their Motorhead's famous songs.
Yeah.
While drunk, needless to say, and while I was trying to interview him seriously. So they loved Lemmy. I mean, Lemmy embodied everything to them and to his fans that was really honest and great about rock and roll. That true ability to express yourself and not give two figs what the other guy might think.
When it came to writing the book, I mean, obviously you've got a backlog of stories, obviously, of having been there. You know, how fondly is Lemmy remembered amongst his peers? I mean, Dave Grohl, who you've also written about with your brilliant Foo Fighters book, which I enjoyed immensely, by the way.
No,
it was my pleasure, I assure you. I mean, Dave Grohl was you know, practically in tears at Lemmy's funeral. In fact, he was in tears at Lemmy's funeral. I mean, how willing were people to talk about Lemmy, and what will be his legacy on the scene?
Everybody loved Lemmy. Everybody wanted to talk about him, and of course everybody has stories, and it's not just other rock stars, it's actresses, it's writers, filmmakers, television producers, radio people, anybody that really came into contact with him always came away with a wonderful story, wonderful insights. And I think that one of the reasons his passing was so emotional was that there was something immortal about Lemmy. You know, while Lemmy still strode the earth, there was hope for all of us. I mean, I'm now in my 50s, and I'm a father and husband, and I gave up all that naughty stuff decades ago. But it was always comforting to know that somewhere out there, Lemmy was still going at it, hammer and tongs, right up to the moment he passed his last breath. I mean, he was at home, sitting playing on a video machine that the manager of the Rainbow, the most famous rock club in Los Angeles, had brought down for him especially. And in the middle of the game, he appeared to fall asleep, but in fact he'd passed on. I mean, I think if Lemmy could have chosen any better rock and roll death, probably it would have been on stage, but the man was on stage 2 weeks before he died. He did his last show. Less than a week before he died, there was a celebratory anniversary concert in Los Angeles at the Whiskey, where Guns N' Roses, Metallica, every big band in America was there to celebrate his 70th birthday and wish him well. So I think his legacy is going to be one that offers hope, inspiration, devil may care, and a lovely nudge and a wink as well.
The book's called Lemmy, the Ace of Spades. It comes out next week. It's by the great Mick Wall. Mick, we can find you on Facebook. You have a website as well, I know.
Yes, I do. And yeah, you can get me. There's my official Facebook page. This is the best place to get me. There's mickwall.com, the website. And you can email me, talk to me, always happy to hear from people. And there's a Twitter account as well. Just like everybody else now, I've got one of those.
Even the Pope's got one. I just want to leave with this quote, because it comes from Lemmy, As Lemmy once said of Mick Wall, Mick Wall is one of the few rock writers in the world who can actually write and seems to know anything about rock music. I can and do talk to him for hours, the poor bastard. Marvellous. Mick, as always, it's been great to speak to you. Have a fantastic weekend. I think we'll play out with a little bit of Bomber, don't you?
Giles, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I think that would be absolutely brilliant.
All right, hold on to your earphones.